So yesterday, basically, we talked mainly about applying the Dirac procedure to a parameterized particle. And then we introduced a bit the formalism of gravity. So I'm just gonna go through the steps that we introduced in the first or second lecture about how to, in general, apply this procedure and how we did that for the parameterized particle. So we had a kinematical phase space, and from there, the first step was to go to a kinematical Hilbert space, which was, for us, the square integrable functions on R2. Why R2? Because we have two parameters, like Q and T. And then, from this Hilbert space, what we want is to quantize our theory. And so the first step for quantizing that is to take our parameters, T, Q, and their conjugated momenta, PT and PQ, and to quantize them. So for that, we consider that T and Q are only multiplicative operators. So operator T applied to psi gives T psi. Same thing for Q. And we consider that the conjugate momenta behave exactly as we are used to. So PT is going to be minus I h bar times the derivative with respect to T. Then we had a constraint that applied to our classical formalism. We can quantize this constraint and make now a C hat as a function of our quantized operators. And here, we recognize that actually C hat is just a Schrödinger equation. And now the goal is to solve our constraint and to establish a physical Hilbert space. So now we have a constraint, which is the Schrödinger equation. So to satisfy this constraint, we just have to satisfy the Schrödinger equation. And that means having a wave function depending on our two parameter, Q and T, which is just the evolution, the time evolution with the Hamiltonian of an initial condition, an initial wave function depending only on the parameter Q. So we can write it exactly like this, an exponential of minus I over h bar Hamiltonian T times psi of Q, a wave function that depends only on Q. And now, if we try to build a physical Hilbert space with these wave functions and the natural inner product that we had with our kinematical Hilbert space, it's not going to work because we have here square integrable functions of R squared, which means that we're going to integrate over T and Q, and it's supposed to not diverge. Except here, if we take wave functions like this and we apply this inner product, the part in T is going to cancel out, and we're going to be left with psi of Q, psi prime of Q, integrated over Q and T. And as it's not a function of T, it's going to diverge because the integration over T is going to give infinity. So we want to get rid of that problem. And to do that, we have to build a physical Hilbert space. We can see that the integration with respect to Q still makes sense. So actually, we can just consider a square integrable function of one parameter, of one variable, the variable Q. And then we can build the inner product that sounds logical for that, which is the integral of psi bar psi dQ. Once we've done all that, the last step is to find gauge invariant observables. And we've seen that these, like a complete set of gauge invariant observables, we've seen that these gauge invariant observables could be the Dirac observables that we introduced in the first lecture and then recall. So from these quantities, from these operators, Q, T, PQ, PT, we can extract two independent Dirac observables depending on Q and PQ. Why not of T? Because we've seen that the right parameterization to take was T would be the clock. So we set T at a given constant parameter, which is the clock tau. And then we express everything as a function of that. So we have only the Q left to be meaningful and its conjugate momentum PQ. So that was essentially the steps for the Dirac procedure on the parameterized particle: finding the kinematical Hilbert space, quantizing the theory and quantizing the constraint, solving the constraint and establishing the shape of the physical Hilbert space, and then finding the gauge invariant observables that go with that. on the form of the Dirac observables. And then we spent a tiny bit of time just introducing formalism of gravity in order to apply all this procedure to way more complicated stuff, apparently. And we just placed ourselves, to begin with, in three dimensions with the classic Einstein-Hilbert action. And what we said was that, so in the vacuum, with no cosmological constant, we had, by the proof that we've done like in GR and also here, the Ricci tensor equal to zero. You can just get that by solving the equations of, by establishing the equations of motion for this action, then taking the trace, it gives the Ricci tensor, the Ricci scalar equals zero, and thus the Ricci tensor equals zero. And because we're in a peculiar number of dimensions, actually this guy is going to have the same number of degrees of freedom as this guy. So if this guy equals zero, this guy being containing the same information, it's also going to be zero. So we have the Riemann tensor equal to zero in three dimensions. And that means no local degrees of freedom, but we still have the possibility of having some global degrees of freedom depending only on the topology. So this is essentially going to be given by the fundamental group, meaning on a surface, if we're in three dimensions, we can always, almost always, I guess, separate our three dimensions into a surface times R. And this surface here can be very simple or less simple. The point is that the fundamental group is going to look at the closed curves, the completely independent, like non-equivalent closed curves on this surface. For a sphere, it's kind of trivial because we take any closed curve on the sphere, we can deform them smoothly to get another closed curve. So basically, it's only going to be trivial. For a more complex surface, so basically for a surface where we have a genus non-zero, more often, so the genus being only the number of holes in the surface, basically. So for the torus, we have genus one. And for the torus, we can find, going through the same point, two curves, two completely independent curves, one that goes like this, that stays in the torus, and one that goes all the way around the torus. And these two curves are going to be completely inequivalent. And this is going to give us some topological characteristic, like the length of these curves, which is like relevant for our problem. And the last thing we did was just to introduce the triads, don't know how to say that, so these things. And their partners, so co-triads. And to say that basically we could take our metric and store all the curvature and complicated information into these triad objects, leaving the metric Minkowskian. And we also noticed that here, as we have three degrees of freedom and three degrees of freedom, and this one has only six, we have some double counting of information in these things. And the very last thing we did was defining the, was basically saying that we already had a connection, like the Levi-Civita connection for GR, usually. And here, in order for to have a good behavior for everything here and to be able to treat with these variables, we also have to define a connection on the triads that behaves exactly like the Levi-Civita connection. And we imposed that the covariant derivative of our triads was zero.
Thanks. Just a clarification on just what you said right now. So how did you count here the number of degrees of freedom?
So just that
freedom?
There were three in the EMU, three in the EMU, so that's nine.
Yeah, no, it's
three times three, like, there is a
so you have three here?
Yeah.
Okay, and three coming from the internal.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Okay, and then, and here you have this, you have only six. So here you have nine and then six, yeah. Okay?
Nine against six, okay, yeah.
Great, is that because you, of course, this is going to be, E can be seen as more or less the square root of G, but the number of independent components that you have here is six for one of this, one of the, yeah, okay? Yeah.
Okay, I have a question in general about dimension and stuff like this. It happens here that if we do like the 6 of the G mu nu minus the 3 of the, no, the, whatever, 9 minus 6, we got the dimension of SO3. Is it always the case that the free index is S, the dimension of SOD?
What is true is that, so you're asking just specifically to this in higher dimension?
Today we were like, oh, we have 9 minus 6, so we have like 3.
Yeah, yeah, but so of course what this number of degrees of freedom should be then, so this means that you have an additional symmetry, and then the dimension of your group, symmetry group, should be the same as the dimension, the number, the extra one, okay, that you have.
Is the group, will the group always be SOD or SO?
Yeah, so here, if you have, if you're working in n dimension with an n bind and everything, you always have a like.
So n.
Yeah, it's going to be always a rotation. Okay. Yeah. But it's in this particular rewriting of the matrix, this particular change of variable. Okay. So what are we going to do today? So we are going to use this to finish to write. To define the first order formulation of 3D gravity to write the action in terms of E and the connection. And then we're going to go to the canonical formulation. And here I think I'm going to teach you today the best lesson you can get is that you shouldn't trust your teacher. And the best example is going to come today because, in fact, I think I tell you something incorrect the previous day, and I'm going to correct that now. But so this is just a good example that if you want to do research, you should really check what everything by yourself, and this is the way you're going to work. Okay, so but it's not, in fact, it's not really that, it's in the examples we have seen for the canonical formulation, this is correct. It's just in general, it's more complicated. Okay, so but first let's, oh no, I'm not supposed to move this one. Let's look at the formulation first of gravity in terms of this triad and connection. So first I just wanted to make sure that this was clear. So here we have a triad which is this object, okay, then the co-triad and this object is the inverse of the triad with respect to the mu index and the I index, okay, and of course how you go from upper to lower index for the internal index. This means that you use the internal metric, which is here just since we are working. So here, yeah, you use eta mu nu vector. So it's, this is true if you are in Lorentzian, but we're going to just be in Euclidean. So we're just going to have the identity here as a metric, okay? So in fact, the way I'm going to put this index, if it's up or down for the internal index, are not going to be important in our case because we're really dealing with the identity metric here. But you should remember that this is plays the role of the metric, and in the Lorentzian case, you would have this eta minor. Okay. And so, what does it mean that this is the inverse? So this means that you need to apply. The metric, the both metric okay, and then as Victor mentioned, we introduce the connection which is going to be used to connect neighbored object with internal indices, okay? And from that, we can define the covariant derivative, which is going to be used to parallel transport with object with internal indices, and also to ensure that proper transformation behavior under internal rotation, okay, for the covariant derivative. So as you have something with only with, so in the case of space-time in GR, your connection is the Levi-Civita connection only in terms of space-time indices, and then you define your usual covariant derivative, okay, the standard one. Okay, so now let's see what does it mean, this compatibility condition that also Victor mentioned. So this is the compatibility and from that, so why are we using this compatibility condition? This allows us to express indeed the spin connection as a function of the triad, the co-triad, and the Levi-Civita connection. Okay, and also it allows that this means that now the derivative is going to commute with the contraction, because you know that if you contract an object with space-time indices, then you're going to obtain with a co-triad, then you obtain an object with internal indices, and you would like that the derivative commute with this kind of contraction. So this compatibility condition is what gives that here. Okay, so now let's take the other point of view. So here you have that this is defined in terms of the Levi-Civita condition connection. But if now I consider that we can define a connection, so I'm just going to inverse this relation, okay? And so this comes really from this not taking as an assumption that here I'm using the Levi-Civita condition. So how do I define this connection here? So we can write this in terms of so maybe I'm missing one index here. Yeah. Okay, hopefully this is correct. And now the question you can ask is that what are the conditions on omega that has okay, so what do I mean here? I mean, what are the conditions that the spin connection should satisfy in order that what I define here, so just using this formula, but now not taking into as an assumption that this covariant derivative is defined using the Levi-Civita condition, the Levi-Civita connection. So what are the conditions on the spin connection that says this connection is indeed the Levi-Civita connection, okay? And so what does it mean? This means that we want to find condition on sigma on omega, such as this connection is metric compatible and torsionless. Okay, these are the two conditions that define your Levi-Civita condition, and so how it that is translated on this one. Okay, so let's first look at the metric condition. So here, let's do this first calculation to see. So if I look at this object here, Okay, so here, this is, in fact, just delta kj by definition, okay? So this means that the covariance, the standard covariance derivative here has to be zero because this is a scalar for the space-time indices. And so now if I expand that, and I'm using the fact that here I want that this covariance derivative is metric compatible. So this means that the covariance derivative acting on this metric is going to be zero. What are the conditions I get on my omega? So using this definition that I have here, in fact, if this is metric compatible, okay, this means that this should be only equal to kj, where here I just lower the index. So this means that kk is kl delta lj. Okay, so I use the internal metric to lower the index. Ouais.
For this one, you use this one.
So here, I'm just expanding that. And
the triangle is the one associated with gamma, or with gamma twiddle?
Yeah, so here, let's say that. So yeah, let's say that now it's associated to, if gamma tilde is gamma, then I get, so let's first, maybe let me explain. So first, this equality just comes from the fact that whatever is the connection here, this is just because it's a scalar with respect to, okay, with respect to the special indices, space-time indices. So it's going to be zero. And then here, it's going to be equal to only that if indeed, because then in this case, we have the metric compatibility. Okay, so this is, you get this equality if that. And here you see that this implies on your spin connection, that this spin connection has to be anti-symmetric. Okay, so here you get that the metric compatibility of gamma is going to imply and of course here this equation, maybe I can use another color like this, I don't have to rewrite everything, since it's with internal indices, this should be also equivalent to say that this covariant derivative then is equal to zero. And then this, what does it mean? This means that, and if you expand that again, you're really going to get that indeed this is zero if this is anti-symmetric. So here you really have that the anti-symmetry of the spin connection imposes that the covariant this covariant derivative is also metric compatible. So because metric compatible, what does it mean? This means that the covariant derivative annihilates the metric. And here this covariant derivative annihilates the metric, the internal metric. So here we get again that the anti-symmetry of omega imposes the metric, who we can say that the covariant derivative D is metric. Okay, so this is for using the metric compatibility. Then we also have the property of the fact that we want this to be torsionless. So I'm not going to do all the steps, but I'm going to show you what is the calculation you should do. And then So here we want to look at the anti-symmetrized derivative to look at the fact what the torsion. We want a torsion-free connection. So let's look at the anti-symmetrized covariant derivative. And because of the compatibility condition, both of these objects are equal to zero. So of course, the difference is also equal to zero. Okay. And you can expand that. And then if you expand that, you're going to get that T that I'm going to define, which is the torsion, the tensor. Then this is equal to and if gamma is torsion free, okay, then this is zero if and this is also the torsion for the spin connection, which is defined. So this we're going to use it because we're going to see that in fact, in as I already mentioned yesterday, when we work with spin connection, triad and spin connection, in fact, we're going to work with more general geometry than just Riemann geometry. We can allow some kind of Cartan geometry, where the torsion is allowed. And so what does it mean? This means that we are not going to impose that the torsion of the connection is directly zero, but we're going to see that this is going just to come up as an equation of motion. So we have, it's not imposed automatically. Okay, so mu k, yeah. Okay, so I'm supposed to have G mu nu, and it's anti-symmetric, so hopefully. So what does it mean now? This means that here, if I have a connection, JK, which is anti-symmetric in its two last indices. Indices plus torsion free, okay? Meaning here that this object is equal to zero. Then this will lead to the fact that we really have to work with the Levi-Civita connection defined with the equation above here, okay? And so one important remark here is that in first order formulation of gravity, we will consider connection. So this is a remark. So this is for first order formulation. Okay. So we're going to write our action, as I already mentioned, in terms of the triad and the connection. So it's what we're going to do now. So we're going to consider that the connection is anti-symmetric. Okay, meaning that we will have the metricity of the connection will be imposed. So this anti-symmetric. So metricity of connection is imposed. But was torsion does not vanish a priori. Okay. So this was just to show you where, why we're going to have more general geometry here, that we could deal with more geometry that in the Einstein-Hilbert formulation. Okay, any questions here? Yeah.
Here, I don't understand what implies what and what is defined and what is.
Okay. Okay, so this is equal to zero just using the fact that we use this compatibility condition. Okay, so, and now if you expand this, okay, using just, so you can expand this using, of course, the covariant derivative being defined with the tilde. Okay, because here you're just going to define, and you're going to get this object, you see that does not depend on this connection, but depend only on the spin connection. Okay, so when you expand that using the definition above, which can be used without making the assumption that we are working with the Levi-Civita connection, then you're going to get that this object has to be equal to this, and so this indeed is zero if this object is torsion free, which makes that. Now that we have the metric compatibility plus the torsion free, you can say now that indeed. So indeed, you can keep here your tilde, and then you end up with condition on omega, which impose that gamma tilde is gamma. Okay.
And then we define Tg, but Tg mu nu is the same, the two Tg mu nu, they are just written in different forms.
Yeah, it's just, so if you expand that, okay, you're going to get something complicated. So if you expand here the covariant derivative, it's going to give you, so if you use the definition that you have here, okay?
Okay.
Then you're going to get a term which is just this partial derivative, then a term in term of the spin connection, and a term in term of the space-time connection, okay? By definition of D. So you just use the definition of D, you expand everything. And since this is zero, what I'm just doing is that I'm keeping on the left-hand side every term in terms of E and the spin connection, and all the term in terms of the space-time connection, which, of course, I don't need to say now that it's the Levi-Civita connection on the other side. Then I get this condition that this is zero if this is zero, or this is zero if this is zero, the way you want. Okay. And the fact that this is zero is exactly the torsion-free condition on the space-time connection. Okay. Yeah. You're not convinced. Okay. Think about it. Let me know if I can explain again if you want. I can try to even explain in another way if this can help. But. Okay, so what is now the next step is to write, so we have all this, the ingredient we need. Now we want to write three-degree first order action for gravity. So we want to write the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is written. So we have G. So in the Einstein-Hilbert action, you have the derivative, the determinant, sorry, for the metric, and you have the Ricci scalar. Okay. And so we know, so this, the metric, we have the expression in terms of the triad. Okay, so this term is going to be easy. But now we need to figure out the Ricci scalar. But then it's maybe easiest to look at the curvature tensor. So let me uh, And so here, what I would like to use, so I want to introduce my spin connection, okay? And the spin connection enters the definition of a covariant derivative. So do you know how to relate the Riemann tensor, the curvature tensor, with the covariant derivative? Okay, so the curvature tensor describes the non-commutativity of the covariant derivative. So here, this is, do I have too many indices? No, maybe not. So I let you check with my indices because sometimes on the blackboard, you don't really see what you're doing. You're too close. So I guess this is correct. And then, but so this has a space-time index. But as I said, we can use now the co-triad to go to the internal index indices. Okay, so this can be written also as something like this. And so now, if I have internal index, this means that this covariant derivative should be the one we just defined with the spin connection. And since we have this compatibility condition, I can put that outside. So here what I get minus d nu. And if you use the expression I gave you of the action of this covariant derivative on a covector for the internal index, okay? Then you get a nice expression here that I'm going to call f mu mu j k. And then you can rewrite even this object using where, let me write explicitly what is this object, and then we're going to go step by step because I have the feeling I'm going to have a question. Okay, so here it's just really using the definition of the covariant derivative I gave you yesterday in terms of the spin connection. This is just, yeah. And this is a curvature tensor. With respect to the spin connection, and it's a two form here. So what do we are we shown here is that the curvature tensor can be written as just using again the trick of rewriting this object as with a vector here. So it's going to be two, a triad and a cotriad here, times f mu mu j k. So is that right? This is, yeah, it should be. Okay, so here I'm really, so this is just using the fact that the Riemann tensor is a way to describe the non-commutativity of the covariant derivative. Then I'm using the fact that I can use the cotriad to go from space-time index to internal index. Then I'm just here using the fact that I have this compatibility condition, so this can go outside. Here I just really use the definition of this or acting on that vector, covector with this internal index. Then I'm reusing the trick that this can be now seen as a vector, a space-time vector, and I get this object here.
Okay. Can you explain why the nabla becomes?
Yeah, you can check that if you do, if you compute that. let me, so here you remember that now we have a internal index, okay? So if you want to parallel transport something with a, you have to use this covariant derivative, okay? And using the definition, you can indeed check that when you have an object which is, so how to say that, that it's not confusing. So what I want to say, so by the, so yeah, it's a bit like when you have this acting just on a scalar, you know that, you know, so if it's a scalar like that you write like this, okay, you know that on this object you want this to be just giving by the spatial derivative, and when you expand you need to have, you have these two. So here it's a bit the same idea that you can check that, so when you have something like this, okay, since because this is just, you're contracting these two, this is just now a space-time object, you can check that indeed this simplify into only this covariant derivative on your space-time object, which is
everything cancel or
yeah. Okay, this is the way we also we have defined, so you can check the definition of the covariant derivative I wrote to check that. Okay.
And then you can no don't erase.
Sorry. Okay, so let's write our action now because we are almost done. So let's do it, and then we can start the canonical analysis. Okay, so we have the Ricci scalar, which is just, so we want in the, in our action we want the Ricci scalar, which is just the contraction of the Ricci tensor. It can also be expressed, the Ricci tensor can be expressed in terms of this curvature tensor. So at the end, what we get for R is just, so this is you can check that in fact you get just mu. So let me just give you now the step. So then there is a bit of, so I don't know if I give you the details or not, because maybe it's tricky. Or maybe I can just, so just give you the fact that, and then you will check on in the lecture note, because I don't think it's so important here. So this is the determinant. So the square root of the determinant of G, because we have seen that more or less G is the cotriad square, okay? It's just going to be given in terms of the determinant of the cotriad or the inverse of the determinant of the triad. Okay, so using that, in fact, you can show that this action, and you also need to work a bit on how you can write the determinant of an n by n matrix. But the details are in the lecture that I'm going to post online. So just, yeah, I'm writing the result, and then you let me know if you want the detail now or if you're fine with just the result. Because I would like to spend rather some time. Oh, especially that I think I forgot to define something for you guys. So. So this is our action, but even giving you, so this is the first step, then you need to figure out, yeah, there are some, so what is interesting here is that first it's linear in the tetrad, okay, in the triad, the cotriad, And this is really the form of the of an action, which what we call a kind of a BF action, where here instead of B, it's called E, but it's a, and this kind of action in any dimension are really topological theory. Okay, so this is valid for any dimension. And this is just the three dimension, and it happens that in three dimensions, this BF theory is gravity. Okay, but we're going to see, for example, in four dimension, that we're going to use this kind of gravity in 4D can be reformulated as a BF theory, so a topological theory, plus some constraint. And it's the formulation we're using when we're doing the path integral approach to go to spin form approach. So really, this kind of BF theory is really well used in loop quantum gravity or spin form approach. Then in the 4D loop quantum gravity approach, of course, we don't have that, but it's...
Sorry, what's the twiddle on the epsilon?
Yeah, so now let me explain the different objects. You're right, good question. So here it's to remind you that this is not a tensor, okay? But it's a tensor density with weight one here, okay? So this twiddle here, so the space-time object, and this was what you had to review in yesterday's tutorial. So see tutorial 2, because here the tilde mean we are working with a tensor density. Okay, and then how do you relate this object with only one internal index with this object with two? Okay, here the one I defined was add two internal index, and here now I have only one. So this is something that we can do in 3D, and which is quite nice because it's allowed to work directly with SU2, so SU2 valued object, devalued object. And this is only because we are in 3D. So, but let me explain more in detail. But where are, so for this, I need to check the definition. Yeah, so you remember that we impose that mu jk is anti-symmetric in these two indices here, okay? So this is imposed. So now we can use the fact that since we want to impose that, we can rewrite this as, is it in this order? Okay, and so automatically writing like now we can work with this object with only one index. And we have introduced the anti-symmetry property in this epsilon here. And so also what is nice with this is that this is the totally anti-symmetric tensor with epsilon 1, 2, 3 is equal to 1. And these are also the structure constant for SU2. So this above our definition really allow you to work with this object are going to be really SU2 valued object, okay? So this is also nice, and it allow you to work with simple object. And of course, you can do the same thing with any of the anti-symmetric tensor in JK, okay? So here we can do the same thing. And okay, so this, now we work with this object, but of course, so you rewrite everything with two indices, and then you use this definition. So the epsilon here are going to appear in this definition, but then you need some work to go from here to here. Yeah. So here you can check lecture notes for some, for the different steps. And so now this is our action, and you see that now if we try to look at the equation of motion, so the first one is going to be very obvious. If the variation with respect to the head is just going to give that automatically, you can see that F, so the curvature tensor is zero. Okay. And now if you look at the variation with respect to omega, then you need to do some integration by part. But the object you're going to get is that the torsion that we define here has to be equal to zero. So you see that now this is not imposed directly, but it appears as an equation of motion. Okay, so here the equation of motion. So the fact that the curvature tensor is equal to zero, the curvature is equal to zero is really can be seen very easily compared to the case with the Einstein-Hilbert action. And you get that this object is equal to zero. So this comes from the variation of your action with respect to E, and this one comes from the variation with respect to omega. Okay, what are the symmetry of this action? Okay, we're going to come back on that, but you have two symmetries here. You have the rotation in the internal index. And the defeo. Okay, so now the aim to this is our starting point, okay? This is now our starting point to perform the canonical analysis. And then the Dirac quantization. OK, so let's go quickly to the canonical analysis. We won't finish, but I just want to. OK, so now it's not working at all. It's not even moving. It's better that it stay above than here. So any question on this part here? So really, also one advantage to work with this variable. So what are the advantages? So first, we now go to work really with an action which is very similar to what you would get with SU2 lattice gauge theory, so we can really borrow some of the tools of this. Then it's also, in fact, if you want to, again, the geometry is more general here. You can work with Cartan geometry, so you can allow torsion. And another aspect is that if you want to, in the metric formulation, we don't know how to include. To couple fermionic degrees of freedom, whereas in this formulation, you can just couple them since you have this internal indices, you use this flat metric. So really this formulation, in addition that it's easier to quantize, our additional interest here. Okay, so let's move to the canonical analysis. And I only have 5 minutes, so I won't be able to tell you much, but I can tell you at least what I wanted to correct from last time. So the first thing to perform a canonical analysis, we're going to choose a slicing of our manifold. And then we choose some adapted coordinates. Okay, so of course, I'm going to consider that my space-time indices now can be written as a time index that usually I will denote with a zero. And A now is going to denote space coordinates. And here we can choose this surface to be such as x0 or t, if you want, is constant. So we consider here equal time surface. And so starting from this action now, what you will see in most of the literature, or even all the literature, is what you do here is that you're going to isolate the time derivative that you have here. Okay, so here, if you look at the time derivative, of course, is going to come from this f here. Where is my definition? Here. And of course, it's going to come from when you have one of this mu index is equal to zero, then you're going to get some. Since this is also antisymmetric, okay, you cannot have. So it's going to be the time derivative of omega a, okay, because you cannot have, you will have only the space index. And of course, to make simple things simple, I'm also going to change notation from now. Sorry, guys. I'm just going to use that. Now I'm going to call omega a. Because it's just, otherwise I'm going to, I'm going to always, it's to be closer to the literature. So otherwise I'm always going to make some like mistakes. So, okay. So now you know that if you see A, this means omega. And if at some point I come back to omega, this means A. So you have a kind of equivalence here. So hopefully you're not going to get lost. So here we can just isolate the time derivative, and what we're going to get is plus now some epsilon even if using this A sometimes can be confusing with then just Simon okay, so few comments. What canonical pair do you have here to describe your phase space? What is your canonical pair here? So here, what I did is just I took this. I changed the sign and maybe there was a 1/2. This is. So here I just, it's just really rewriting thing using this kind of splitting of space of coordinates and just trying to isolate the time derivative. So what is your...
Why do epsilon has lost an index?
Yeah, so here it's because, so you know that if you have two in, so now you only have two spatial index, okay?
Okay.
So you can add the third one has to be the zero all the time if I have spatial index here. Okay, because I only otherwise it's all the other terms are zero. If you have something like this, A, B, C, since this A, B, C can take only two values, it means that one of these two will be equal. Okay. So
play a zero in the first place.
Yeah. So here. Good question. Thanks. Okay, so what is your canonical pair here that you have?
A and A.
Yeah, so you have A. And it's not exactly E, okay? Because it's a densitized triad now. Okay, because you have this term here. So it's what we call a densitized triad that I'm going to call. And then it's where is just so given by epsilon AB and all the other Poisson bracket are going to be zero. Okay, but if you remember what we have done in and here, so this also means that these variables, they don't have any derivative. Okay, so they are like Lagrange multiplier. And here too. And these are our constraints. Okay, so this is going to be what we call the flatness constraint. And here you can see what is going to be the Gauss constraint. Okay, so these are constraints. And of course, we're going to relate this constraint. The next step is to relate this constraint with the symmetry of our action. Okay, this, you know that this constraint should generate symmetries. And yeah, and this is what we're going to call the flatness. Yeah.
Is that a Poisson bracket, or have you already written that as a commutator type thing?
No, it's a Poisson bracket.
So what's the Dirac delta there? I mean, how, maybe how is this Poisson bracket defined? Is it now a functional?
Yeah. Okay. It's a functional Poisson bracket. We are, yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry. So before we were just using, with a toy model, we are just doing with a, well, now we're dealing with functional, so we are dealing with fields, so we have functional. Very good, thanks. But so quickly, doing that, it's not at all what I've been told you in the previous lecture to do. Okay, because if you remember, what did I tell you? I told you, okay, you start with an action written as a Lagrangian, okay? And then to find your what you call the primary constraint, you look at the conjugated momenta of all your variables. Okay, so here we should compute the momenta of all these variables. And what we would get if you do that is that, of course, the momenta, momentum associated to this variable are zero. And this would be our primary constraint. And then this flatness constraint and this Gauss constraint would appear as secondary constraint, as we did exactly with the, it's exactly the example we did. Not exactly, because here we are, we're still going to deal with first class constraint, but the example of the particle moving on a circle, where Q3 was there, and I think it's Nana who asked me, but we already have here a Lagrange multiplier. Why are you computing this? And if you do everything correctly, then it's indeed here. We should also do the same. And what you end up is that you get two primary constraints, and these constraints appear as secondary constraints. But the point is that, so, and then the, it's, you're done, okay? You have all your constraints. So you have two primary constraints and two, no, it's, in fact, it's more because you have many indices here, but you see the idea? It's kind of two. Here, in fact, you have three, here you have three, and then you would have three, three. So it's more like nine, nine, and but all these constraints are first class, okay? And this is, I think what was not clear in what I told you is that here you can have primary plus secondary plus et cetera, all constraint. And then when you go to the distinction first class, second class, okay, it's all of them can be first class, second class. So really, in this example, the secondary constraints that appear are the Gauss and the flatness constraint are going to be also first class. Okay, so this means that here in this example, you will have two kind of primary constraints, the two secondary constraints, and all of them are first class. So how do you go now to this? So this is what I wanted to modified, because I'm not sure I was clear last time. And I think maybe with the example we had, the first class was always a subclass of the primary. Okay, but this is not the case. in general. In general, you really need to do all these analyses again and find first class, second class, and first class can also be some secondary constraint. Okay, so here this means that all these constraints here we have are first class. How do we go to this formalism where here we only are dealing with this phase space and these two constraints? So you see that in fact here we are already in a reduced phase space, and what we did is since we had some primary constraint on which are first class on the Lagrange on the conjugated momentum to this variable, then they are first class. So this means that generate kind of gauge transformation, so you can fix the gauge. Okay, and so here in fact the gauge fixing has been done. But usually in the literature that you will see, most of the time we directly start from here because these are really the constraints we are interested in. So in fact, we're directly working in this reduced phase space. And I think it's time to conclude. So I'm just going to post a reference where the two approaches are done, meaning you really start from all your variable and you compute all the primary, secondary, and then you fix the gauge to arrive here. Okay, but usually in most of the literature you will directly start here, and our constraint will be only these two constraints, or in fact it's 3 plus 3 because you have indices, so Gauss, and we're going to show in the next lecture that these constraints are first class. Okay, and they generate gauge transformation which are related to the symmetry of the action. So the flatness constraint is going to generate, in fact, a translation. And here, this is going to generate some rotation symmetry. OK? OK, thanks. Sorry, guys, for. Wow.